Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll hear some of the Christmas messages on the Calls from Home radio program.
Merry Christmas. No matter what you're going through, no matter what it looks like, no matter what it feels like, it's going to be all right. We just got to hold on.
The holidays often bring back memories of years past, and this is especially hard for those with a family member or loved one who's passed away.
I kind of almost didn't realize that I was struggling that much, and I couldn't really talk to people in my family because they were experiencing the same grief that I was.
And we'll hear about a former Marine in West Virginia who's now helping people pull themselves out of poverty.
One of the keys to success in this work is you have to focus on the people, and you have to unleash the potential that's already located within those trapped in poverty.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We begin this episode in Reading, Pennsylvania. It's one of the poorest cities in the country. So it didn't help lift spirits there when the city put up an ugly, scraggly Christmas tree in the middle of downtown. Then something remarkable happened. The city rallied around that shabby tree. If that sounds like a classic Christmas special to you, Ben Allen from member station WITF reports that you're not alone.
Around town, they're calling it the Charlie Brown Christmas Tree, with branches randomly jutting out every few feet. Mounted on a downtown street corner, the crowd of about 100 had to stand in the street to get a view.
I mean, it's known for being, like, kind of ugly, but, like, even still, it's just, like, the fact of Christmas.
That's Jessica Flores, a student at a local Reading school. And resident Karen Wolkowitz sums it up.
We're the underdog city, and it's the underdog tree.
Back in November, city workers made their annual visit to a local farm to collect the tree, but the owner wouldn't let them drive on his wet fields. Looking for a quick solution, they found a scraggly substitute in a park. Then the outcry started. City Council President Francis Acosta initially wanted it gone because of the way it looked, but then reversed course and saved it from the mulcher. National coverage of the tree tiff might have swayed him, but he says it also built a foundation for good.
I mean, we have the private sector, we have community leaders, we have regular people, elected officials, all together doing something that is good for the city.
Even though Acosta once pushed for replacing the downtown showcase with one bought with his own money, he led the event.
I think that we have all been following this Christmas tree story.
A local TV anchor read from the book by Charles Schultz.
I'll take this little tree home and decorate it, and I'll show them it will really work in our play.
A man came dressed as Charlie Brown, and winners of a Letter to the Tree contest even went home with Snoopy stuffed animals.
And with that, we count 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Alicia Dunkelberger, a Reading resident, sees a lesson in the saga of the skimpy tree.
Look around. You don't see this on a street corner every day. You don't see it every year. You don't see it happening all the time. But if you get a lot of people to show for something and care about something, then that just shows this is the community that actually cares.
In recent years, large factories have shut down and many families have left Reading to look for other opportunities. Now, less than 9% of adults in the city have a college degree. But for people like Keith Zilaskowski, who donated money to decorate the spruce, each twinkling light offers a way forward.
Hope for Reading. Hope that we're not going to be the Charlie Brown of the nation.
Many hope Reading's story will follow the same path as the trees, initially dismissed as ugly and poor, then held up as a symbol of what can happen when a community works together. For NPR News, I'm Ben Allen in Reading, Pennsylvania.
So what's the best thing about winter? Eating snow, say the children of the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier. That story and more up next. You're Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs, to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
What's the best thing about winter? Eating snow, say the children of the Allegheny Fronts, Reed Frazier.
The first snow of the year brings a special sound out of my two daughters. It's a little like what I hear when they get something unexpected, a surprise scoop of ice cream or a new bike. But snow on the ground after a year without it induces a different sort of sound. You hear breath filling their lungs and a long pause while it stays there. I heard that sound recently when they opened the blinds and beheld the season's first real deposit of snow. The ground, which had sat gray and brown and mealy green for months, was caked with a short, neat frosting. We bundled the girls up and sent them out the front door. I watched through the window as they played in our front yard. There wasn't enough snow on the ground to do much with. They couldn't build a snowman, and their little hands were no good at packing snowballs. But they found another use for the white stuff. I watched them scoop snow into their mittens and lick the clumps of white in their palms. When they came back inside, Ruby, my 3.5-year-old, said triumphantly, "I hated snow." It sounds really hokey, I know, but I have to admit this. Snow and I, we have always had a special kind of relationship. It's kind of like what some children feel toward a special stuffed animal or toy. I don't just like it because it's fun, although I am a fan of skiing, sledding, snowshoeing, virtually any snow-based recreation. No, what sells me on snow is that it brings a kind of serenity to the world. It is the embodiment of a fresh start, giving a clean glaze to even the harshest of landscapes. If I ever feel lonely or sad, nothing can be as comforting as standing outside during a nighttime snowfall, taking refuge in its stony silence. And so it gave me pleasure that morning to watch my children reveling in it in our front yard, eating up snow as if it were cotton candy falling from the sky. I'd done a lot of snow eating when I was a kid. I loved how it quickly melted in your mouth, its feathery texture reduced to dense clumps of ice and then water in a matter of seconds. Back in our yard, my daughters were asking to walk the dog with me. They spent most of the walk dining on freshly fallen snow in our neighbors' front yards. Anya, my 6-year-old, wanted me to eat some of hers, but I'm an adult now, and grown-ups don't eat snow. I tried not to think about what was in the snow. I didn't want to take away from their joy, so I let them eat it anyway, with the caveat that they avoid snow that was yellow or brown or gray. And they seemed to understand that. What good is life, after all, if you can't taste snow? Rounding the block, Anya turned to me, offering me a mitten full of snow. There was so little in her palm it could have blown away, but there was no wind. "Eat some snow, Daddy," she said. I leaned over, and I ate the snow out of her mitten. The snow tasted exactly the way it had when I was a child. It was light and airy and gone too soon.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. Years ago, children dreamed of getting much simpler toys. Last year, Cecilia Mason visited with Harpers Ferry National Historical Park Ranger Melinda Day in the town's old general store to learn what children living in the town in 1864 wished Santa would bring.
To the modern eye, many of these wooden toys that we have here in the dry goods store aimed at the Christmas of 1864 just seem like kind of fun, innocent things to play with. But when you start connecting the history of the time period with each toy, it starts to take on different relevance and meaning. For instance, how many small children are emulating what their father would do by marching off to war, by now playing with a pop gun? And so this little gun that is purely wooden is very loud, and it probably makes a young child very proud that their father is serving their country. Another thing that would remind us that we're at war is a toy sword that young children would march around the Christmas tree, marshaling their toy soldiers off to war. A fun game for the parlor was called Nine Pins, and the wooden pins, could be set up on mom's dining room table. She probably wouldn't be very happy about it, but there's a little bowling ball of sorts that's made out of wood, and the children would knock that down. The Dancing Jack, that is aimed at an African-American story. He's dancing for joy. He does what is described in the time period as the grapevine twist. Would you like to hear it?
Sure.
It's a board that has the puppet of sorts suspended over it. And when the board is hit, the jack starts. So the Dancing Jack reflects that joy that is pending in America in 1864, that emancipation, and that's what this war is going to bring, emancipation for 4 million.
These toys look really simple. I assume, though, for their time, they were very desired by children.
They were, and we're starting to see more toys being produced for the mass market in America than just placing something edible on a Christmas tree that used to be your main gift. Now we're starting to place things under the tree. That's starting to change in America. And eventually with the popular Thomas Nast drawings, the heavy Santa with the sooty suit, now he's sliding down your chimney. When he is now married with the Christmas tree in the 19th century, boom, then modern Christmas is born.
We've looked at what the children might have wanted for Christmas. Let's talk about a few other family members you might have in here that they might have wanted for Christmas.
Many soldiers that were stationed here in 1864 are hoping for a package in the mail. Mail call is very popular every day. Just a small word from home, a letter of encouragement, or better still around Christmas, can you please send me something warm here at the war? And so just like today, we're buying each other warm mittens, like these knitted mittens that we have here in the dry goods store that are beautiful with the thumb in it and the entire hand covered. Soldiers are asking for scarves, something warm to put around their neck. Everyone's looking for treats. Everybody's looking for something special around the holidays, even though it may not be on the same scale as today's Yuletide observations. And so it's usually related to food. What kind of specialty candies can you actually get 150 years ago that aren't made in the summertime? And the answer is it's called barley candy. They called it clear candy toys. Your local confectioner would pour this hot molten sugar right into a cast iron mold, and when it would cool and set up, he would take the cast iron mold apart, and then sitting in the middle of your dining room table to show your friends is something called a dancing horse, or maybe it's a choo-choo. It's a very large candy object that you would then break and share with the family.
That was Harper's Ferry National Historical Park Ranger Melinda Day showing Cecilia Mason what gifts were given at Christmas 150 years ago. The man behind the lyrics of Frosty the Snowman, Peter Cottontail, and Smokey the Bear is none other than West Virginian Jack Rollins. His song about a magical snowman coming to life and bringing holiday cheer can be heard almost everywhere this time of year. In 2011, Rollins was inducted into the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame. West Virginia Public Broadcasting, Liz McCormick reports.
Hey, fellas, why don't you tell the kids about your ice-cold friend?
All right. Frosty the Snowman was a jolly, happy soul, with a corncob pipe and a button nose and two eyes made out of coal.
Jack Rollins, who's also known as the real Frosty the Snowman, was born in Scottsdale, Pennsylvania in 1906, but he moved to Keyser, West Virginia with his family when he was 3 or 4 years old. He ended up growing up in Keyser and as an adult lived in New York, California, and Ohio, but West Virginia was always special to him.
Your home is where your heart is, and his mother and his brother settled in Keyser, West Virginia.
That's Champ Zumbrin. He's a big fan of Rollins and even wrote an article about Rollins' life that was published in Allegheny Magazine in Cumberland, Maryland.
And he would come home at every opportunity while his mother was alive. In fact, if you go to the cemetery, he's buried next to his mother.
Zumbrin is a retired forest ranger from Maryland, and he's also a musician. While working as a forester, he performed Jack Rollins' song, Smokey the Bear, every weekend for more than 30 years.
'Cause everybody knows that he's the fire-preventing bear. Smokey the Bear, Smokey the Bear.
In 2011, Zumbrin received a surprising phone call.
The chief of the Smokey Bear program nationally learned that Jack Rollins, who wrote Smokey the Bear, was going to be inducted to the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame, and they were reaching out to the National Forest Service Office to find out some information about Jack Rollins. And since I have been researching Jack Rollins, they contacted me and connected me with the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame, and they asked would I share my information with them. I said, sure, anything to help Jack out.
The West Virginia Music Hall of Fame also learned about Zumbrin's history singing Smokey the Bear, so the group asked if he would sing at Rollins' induction ceremony. Zumbrin said yes. The West Virginia Music Hall of Fame was, however, still looking for a family member to accept the award on Rollins' behalf. That's when Jack Rollins' grandson, James Busmeyer from Ohio, came forward to accept the award for his grandfather.
Frosty the Snowman was a jolly, happy soul. With a corn cob pipe and a button nose and two eyes made out of coal.
The song has become a classic. This time of year, we hear Frosty the Snowman playing on radio, television, movies, and in shopping centers. It was written in 1950, but is still so popular today, and Champ Zumbrin knows why.
Because I think people always need songs that are happy and have a message of joy, and that's what Jack was all about. If you want to know Jack Rollins, just look at the lyrics in his songs. They're happy, they're innocent, they're full of joy. I think people always need to celebrate and be reminded that life is not a drudgery, and there's a spirit in life that's joyful, and those songs, if you listen to them, are joyful, happy songs.
Frosty the Snowman was a jolly, happy soul.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Charleston.
Two eyes made out of coal.
Frosty the Snowman.
Hey, pull up on the top.
Round and around and around.
Snow-capped mountains in part of Appalachia create beautiful scenes and a playground for skiers. Ski resorts are opening across the region like Snowshoe and Winter Place in West Virginia, Ober-Gatlinburg in Tennessee, Big Boulder and Whitetail in Pennsylvania, and more. But according to this next report, that could all change. It takes a closer look at Pennsylvania's skiing industry. It brings about $360 million into the state. But climate scientists predict that half of the ski resorts in Pennsylvania could be forced to close in the coming decades. That's because it'll be too warm to maintain snow cover. At the end of last year's ski season, we sent the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant to the slopes to learn more. And here's her report.
It's a little rainy, despite the cold wind blowing at the Blue Knob Mountain Resort in Claysburg, east of Johnstown. Rocky Sproul is right at home. He grew up skiing Blue Knob and still lives just over the ridge.
Actually, my dad worked here and ran the ski school desk for years.
Really?
Yeah. So
now Sproul is a retired school teacher and a part-time ski instructor. His bright red cheeks and friendly smile make him a favorite at Blue Knob. He jumps off the ski lift, ending his lesson with a young girl, and heads out to the expert trails to enjoy the view, the quiet, and a vertical drop he says will curl your hair.
Can you see the valley floor? Yeah, and it's straight pitch from here to there. It's all soft bumps right now. You can see how soft the snow is.
It's midweek and the slopes look sparse. There aren't many skiers or lines at the lifts. The early season around Christmas time started slow at Blue Knob and elsewhere in the region, but Sproul says cold and snow the rest of the winter have actually made for a good ski season at Blue Knob.
This has been a great winter, all in all, for Western Pennsylvania.
That hasn't been the case in many recent years, particularly the winter of 2011-12, one of the warmest on records. Kids were in t-shirts, not thinking about ski slopes. Blue Knob owner Rich Gauthier says they lost more than $150,000 that season. Some bigger resorts lost much more, in the millions. Gauthier says winters like that are one reason he spent more than $1 million on snowmaking equipment.
Everybody has to make snow nowadays. Even out west in the Rockies, they're making snow at the lower level. You can't count on Mother Nature to do it for you.
But Mother Nature doesn't always allow humans to work around her either. Snow, natural or man-made, doesn't hold if temperatures aren't low enough. It's got to stay below freezing at night to maintain the cover.
Yeah, no. Well, that's the bottom line for our model.
Daniel Scott is director of the Interdisciplinary Center on Climate Change at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. His team has published predictions for the ski industry based on what's happened in past warm winters.
Whenever we've talked to the ski industry, they tell us don't tell me how much snow is going to fall. I don't care. Tell me how cold it's going to be, and can I make enough snow? And that's what our model does.
To be considered economically viable, a ski resort has to be open at least 100 days per season. That means it needs to be below freezing temperatures long enough to maintain snow cover for 100 days. Scott's team modeled climate predictions separately for eastern and western Pennsylvania, and they looked at different scenarios, if greenhouse gas emissions were at low levels or at high levels. Across the state and at both emission scenarios, they predict a loss of 15% to 20% of the ski season over the next couple of decades. Scott says that's not too bad.
By mid-century, I would think most of your ski areas with advanced snowmaking would still have a good chance of being in operation.
Scott says some states, such as Connecticut, will lose all of their ski resorts, while Vermont will likely maintain all of its skiing. But Pennsylvania is right on the bubble of that 100-day season. He says a key factor will be getting cold weather early enough. Many ski resorts depend on being open for Christmas and New Year's, but they need cold enough temperatures for the snow to stick. This year in Pennsylvania, it rained during that holiday week, but otherwise it's been a cold, dry winter, and that's kept the slopes in good shape. But if greenhouse gas emissions continue at higher levels, Scott doesn't think PA ski resorts will make it past the year 2070.
Later century, particularly under the warmer scenarios, now you're looking at a 50% loss in your ski season, so that's no longer sustainable at that level.
The Union of Concerned Scientists says under similar models, the closest major ski resort to Philadelphia would be nearly 300 miles. Pittsburghers would have to drive 500 miles to go skiing. At Blue Knob, which is just a couple of hours from Pittsburgh, owner Rich Gauthier doesn't give long-term predictions like this much credence.
It's kind of like the weather people. You know, how nice is it to be able to get paid and be wrong? I mean, that probably drives me crazy more than anything. I always say that if you want the weather, if you don't like the weather on one report, just turn to another one because you'll get it different and you keep going until you find the one you like.
Researcher Daniel Scott doesn't dispute these kinds of comments.
They're exactly right. You know, it's variable year to year. That's what weather brings. And what we would expect is just we would get more of those warm years over time. And so by the 2050s, what we're considering to be a record warm year now would actually be sort of a fairly average winter then.
Scott says the problem for many resort businesses is that they can't sustain the lost revenue of even two warm winters in a row. But Scott's climate models and others that look at Pennsylvania show that things don't have to go downhill for the state's ski industry. If the amount of greenhouse gases is reduced, they predict many more ski resorts could remain viable. Knowing that has politicized an industry known for its laid-back style. In recent years, skiing trade groups have been lobbying in Washington on various climate and energy bills. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
It's time to explore What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This time, we're going to my home place. It's home to a striking old coal company store and a train yard. Often on our show, we hear tales about how a town supposedly got its name, only to then find out the history books prove the legend to be simply a tall tale. Today, we'll put my hometown to the test. Itman, West Virginia. And we'll find out if the story I believed as a child about Itman is true. We'll hear the story after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. We've shared a lot of memories on this show during the holiday season. So many of those memories are from the home place. For me, it was Itman, West Virginia, a coal camp town that's best known for a beautiful company store in need of attention. My childhood was spent in a small coal camp house built, I'm told, close to the 1900s that sat high on a mountain just above a noisy train yard. Just across neighboring Arista, or as we always called it, Herndon Mountain, was my grandmother's house. We made the trip every Sunday for church, so it only made sense to me that's where the settlers of my home place must have come from.
Now, here's the story about Ipman that I heard. You see, two men were looking for a place to settle. They'd been traveling all night, and when they got across the mountain, the travelers decided to set up camp. As they sat around the fire, resting their bones, they looked around. One looked at the other and said, "This is it, man." The other nodded in agreeing and that they had found a place to call home and send their wives and children.
Which is a great, great story. I'm going to use that occasionally. But what actually happened?
David Bug Stover, Wyoming County Circuit Clerk and local storyteller, sets the record straight and shares more about the company store.
There was a guy who was wanting to put a coal mine in there and build a town. And his name was I T Man. And it's named after him. Now, and what he did is, and he built that house, he built it quickly. They used the railroad to go up to Ritter and Mabin, and they got all these prefab houses built there, and they simply brought them down on a train, unloaded those things, and built Ipman almost overnight. Now, that great big beautiful building that's there, the old Ipman Company store and mine headquarters, IT Man was going back to Italy to visit, and he saw what apparently was a prison, though no one is 100% sure of that I know of. And he just fell in love with the building of what it looked like. So he got the plans. And he came back and he built that. Apparently over in Italy somewhere, there's a building that looks exactly like it. It is as fine a piece of architecture as anywhere in southern West Virginia. Beautiful. And that's what I know about Ipman, IT Man. And it is the place to be, man.
The businessman's first name was Isaac T. Mann. The company store was a grand post office when I was a young child, then a homeless shelter. Former West Virginia State Senator Billy Wayne Bailey now owns the building. Bailey announced plans to renovate the structure almost 5 years ago, but so far, no progress appears to have been made. If you have another story about Ipman or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Holidays are a time to create new memories with their loved ones. Those memories become so precious and even painful when those loved ones are away. For this next segment, we want to pause for those that might not feel they have much to celebrate this holiday season and perhaps give a little hope for those suffering. This first story is about a bereavement group for folks dealing with the death of a loved one. When a loved one has died, the holidays can be a painful reminder of a life that used to be. WNKU's Sherry Lawson reports on one group serving Northern Kentucky, Greater Cincinnati, and Indiana that offers help and hope during the holiday season.
It's Wednesday afternoon at Lakota East High School. 16-year-old Clara Elam is using sparkling red and green pipe cleaners and miniature gold stars to make a Christmas ornament for her sister. Tears stream down Clara's face as she remembers 19-year-old Jessica, who died earlier this year of pancreatic cancer.
This is her favorite time of year, so she was actually not even supposed to make it past Thanksgiving. She did, and she finally got to graduate high school when she was 19.
Clara belongs to Companions on a Journey. The faith-based group offers support to anyone who has suffered the death of a loved one.
Introduce yourselves, maybe your first name, what year you are, and who it was that died.
Executive Director Sheila Monofo-Canoza started the group in 1997, a few years after the death of her husband. Now it serves nearly 800 people from ages 4 through adult each month. Volunteer facilitators use techniques such as making ornaments or writing letters to deceased loved ones. They also lead discussions and ask very specific questions.
So at Christmas time, things might be different, right?
We want them to feel safe, and we want them to know this is a place that they can share whatever they want to. And because with grief and during the holidays, there's going to be that sadness.
I'm Brooke Hill, and I lost my grandpa August 25th, 2014.
Brooke's grandpa was suffering from severe depression and committed suicide. Brooke says this group has been a huge help because some people said hurtful things about the way her grandpa died.
I kind of almost didn't realize that I was struggling that much, and I couldn't really talk to people in my family because they were experiencing the same grief that I was. When I came here, it was like everyone just opened up and they could relate to the pain that I was feeling.
On this day, six students and three facilitators share chocolate chip cheesecake, cookies, and stories of grief and hope. Ash Terrell shares a memory of her mom who died 3 years ago.
My mom was always really Christmassy and would always try and decorate every part of the house. Not even kidding, even the bathrooms had something that sparkled.
On December 14, 2011, Joshua Niederman lost his dad to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. On Christmas morning, he and his siblings will eat ice cream for breakfast in memory of their dad, who loved ice cream. Joshua says it was his mom who convinced him to attend the grief group.
I mean, you still have your bad days, but being able to come here and talk makes the good days outweigh the bad.
According to Sheila Monofo-Canoza, one in seven Americans lose a parent or sibling before age 20. She says when that happens, children and teens can be unintentionally overlooked. 14-year-old Rebecca Addison says when her mom died 7 years ago, the family didn't know how to grieve. The high school sophomore says grief support has been life-changing.
It helped improve the relationship I have with my family because being around each other was just, it was rough because we'd see my mom in each other. And I would spend hours locked away in my room because I couldn't face them.
Leaning back in his chair, Nick DeWitt says it's only been 2 years since his dad died of kidney cancer. He's not sure how his family will remember his dad this Christmas.
I kind of want to go to the cemetery and like light a candle or something, you know, leave something there. This is only like our second Christmas. Second.
While the stories are sad, the friendships are powerful and the opportunity for healing is palpable, especially during the holiday season. This year, Companions on a Journey has served more than 3,000 grieving people of all ages. Groups meet monthly at a number of locations in the greater Cincinnati and Dayton areas of Ohio, as well as Indiana and northern Kentucky. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Sherry Lawson.
Last week, we heard about a radio program from WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, called Hip Hop from the Hilltop, Calls from Home. The show is broadcast live every Monday night from 7 until 10. During the last hour, the program airs messages from families of people who are incarcerated in medium and high-security prisons throughout Central Appalachia. Our producer, Roxy Todd, brings us this look at what the radio show means for the families of those inmates who face many obstacles trying to communicate with their loved ones.
Love me well to try and live in all by yourself. Sometimes I find myself dreaming.
For people in maximum security prisons, like the Red Onion State Prison in Pound, Virginia, inmates cannot receive any incoming calls. Inmates are only allowed 20-minute conversations, which can cost anywhere from 14 to 25 cents per minute. Their family members are often footing the bill to pay these account balances each month. Sylvia Ryerson, whose DJ name is Sly Rye, is part of a team of DJs that helps put Calls from Home on the air each Monday night. Sylvia points out that these expensive phone rates are just part of the reason why communication is especially difficult for low-income families.
Travel costs to get here are really high. I mean, we're talking about a region here in eastern Kentucky and southwest Virginia where there's no public transportation, there's no train station, there's no bus station. There's virtually no way to get here unless you own a private vehicle or can afford to rent one. And so for a lot of families, just the cost of getting here is makes it virtually impossible to stay, to actually visit.
Sylvia is often taping the messages that are broadcasted in calls from home. And so she spent a lot of time listening to these calls.
Sometimes the kid will say, hey, Dad, I did this today in school or said something like that. And then they'll pause and they'll wait for their parent to respond. And then you'll hear, the mom or the grandma in the background and say, oh, no, it's just a message. Like, they're not there. It's just a message.
I miss you. I'll be glad when you come home. Hi, Uncle Frankie. I really miss you. This is Sarah, your niece. I hope that you get out of prison very soon. I mean, I don't even really know you. All I can do is just hear you on the phone or something. I miss your aunt's house, It's really lonely without anybody to talk to. I'm 5 years old now. I'm tall. My mom is doing good. Love you.
And for the spouses, the calls from home program has become a weekly ritual. This is true of Michelle, who leaves messages for her fiancé every single week.
My name is Michelle, and I live in Northern Virginia. When I call into the Calls from Home show, I'm typically leaving a message for William Griffin.
Michelle, who wasn't comfortable sharing her last name, admits that while her fiancé does have a record of violence, since the two of them reconnected a few years ago and have been communicating regularly while he's in prison, he's made enormous improvement in his behavior.
To hear somebody else calling in is just encouraging to know. There are people out there that are concerned about what we're going through. There are people out there that want to see us do better, that understand that encouragement is what helps rehabilitate.
She adds that the cost for her fiancé to call her can be exorbitant.
Our phone calls in any given month could run between $100 to $300. It just depended on how often we were speaking.
This Christmas Eve, Michelle does get the chance to travel down to Big Stone Gap, Virginia, to see William. But not everyone has someone who can afford to make the journey. Michelle makes a point of listening to the Calls from Home show each week, hearing messages from families from all over the country, sending words of encouragement inside the prisons.
You're talking about a lot of these guys who have been transferred from urban cities. Some of them have even been transferred from different states. And they're placed, hours away where it's difficult for family members to come visit them.
The Monday before Christmas, the Calls from Home DJs open the phone lines for messages for an additional hour, so as many families as possible could get through. As we head towards the new year, we wanted to play a few of the calls from this week's program, sharing prayers for improvement and better times ahead.
Devon Hall, it's Monday night, telling you that we love you, and we're coming from North Carolina, Virginia, etc. You know where we at. We know it's that time, it's that season where, sometimes you feel a little sad or a little down because we're not together, but just know in our hearts we are together. Merry Christmas, fellas, and Happy New Year. Of course, I'll be in and spoke to you again before that all happens. Love you guys. Be safe. Take care of yourself. Be positive. Stay prayed up. Take care.
Merry Christmas. No matter what you're going through, no matter what it looks like, no matter what it feels like, it's going to be all right. We just got to hold on.
Yes, Kyle Smith, this is David, your father. I just want to wish you a happy Christmas and best of luck to you and best wishes for the new year's. And looking forward to seeing you when the day comes. And I appreciate it and appreciate you just being my son, okay? I'll talk to you later. Love you always. Bye.
Special thanks to Sylvia Ryerson, a.k.a. Sly Rye, with WMMT for providing those audio clips from the Calls from Home radio program. The show's broadcast live from the Apple Shop studio every Monday evening from 9 until 10. Now we'll meet a decorated veteran whose experiences in war leads him to believe that extreme poverty is a contributing factor to terrorism and insurgency. As producer Gene Snediger for the Inspiring West Virginians reports, ex-Marine Jake Harriman is now on a very different mission.
I thought we'd go across, kind of show you some of the farm.
40-year-old Jay Carriman shows me his home place, the small wooden house and farm where he grew up. It's in the Wetzel Settlement, a tiny community on top of a hill in Preston County, West Virginia. The oldest of four children, Jake is tall, blonde, and looks like a football player. When he was growing up, his family was considered poor.
Technically, we did live in poverty when I was growing up. According to the government standard of living on less than $20,000 annually. But I remember growing up, I never really felt like we were poor. I never felt like I wanted for anything.
So this is a field much smaller than it was before where we used to plant all our food.
Jake's family raised their own food and hunted for most of their meat. His dad worked several jobs to support the family and built their farmhouse himself. Everybody worked hard, but they had fun too.
This hillside used to be just packed full of briars, and so we used to make forts and tunnels in the briars, actually, just like the rabbits, you know, and we used to play war and other stuff in here. There's a little spring right over this hill here by these trees, and it was kind of like this little magical place that we would go as kids to kind of like dream about big stuff, you know, like what do we want to be when we grow up, you know, where are we going to go? It was a secret. You could always kind of go here and get away, and nobody would ever find you. I used to dream big there and try to figure out how I was going to make a difference in the world.
Who would have guessed then that a poor farm boy from rural West Virginia would one day try to tackle, head on, one of the world's biggest problems, extreme poverty? But that's what Jake Harriman, former Marine platoon commander and now social entrepreneur, is trying to do. 6 years ago, he started an organization called Nuru International.
Nuru gave me a loan of maize seed and fertilizer, and I am working harder than ever before. I believe that with Nuru, for the first time, my children will not know a single day of hunger.
Nuru International is an organization that was built to defeat extreme poverty in remote rural areas around the world. So we're trying to build the world's first self-sustainable, self-scalable, integrated development model to fight extreme poverty. It's a four-pronged approach. We attack the needs of hunger, inability to cope with economic shock, preventable disease and death, and lack of quality education for children.
Nuru defines extreme poverty not in strict economic terms, but as the lack of meaningful choices for basic human rights. When they go into a new area, they ask the community members themselves what they believe they need to come out of poverty, then listen to their suggestions. They train local leaders in farming, business, and management skills, give them loans to start small businesses so that the community members are able to pull themselves and their neighbors out of poverty and stay out. It's called bottom-up development.
One of the keys to success in this work is you have to focus on the people, and you have to unleash the potential that's already located within those trapped in poverty. Help them become part of the solution.
In Swahili, the word Nuru means light or hope. Over the last 7 years, Jay Carriman and his colleagues at Nuru have tested this bottom-up approach to ending extreme poverty in the Kuria district of Kenya and in Ethiopia. Today, more than 30,000 people who once lived in extreme poverty have had their lives transformed.
We want to open source our model. We want to share it with other organizations and governments and train them how to use it so that we can spread the success of this model and the impact of giving people more and more people choices more quickly.
The goal is big: to end extreme poverty in remote rural areas in our lifetime. But the man with this big vision started small. From the farm in Preston County, Jake went on to study engineering at West Virginia University and later at the U.S. Naval Academy, then spent 8 years as a Marine platoon commander in special operations and was awarded a Bronze Star. His experience in Iraq convinced him that much of the terrorism and insurgency in the world today is driven by extreme poverty. So he left the Marines and went into the social entrepreneurship program at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. There, he recruited 30 of his classmates and 6 faculty members to help him start Nuru International. But what, I wondered, made a kid from West Virginia try to tackle something so bold, so difficult, to try to change the world in a way that no one has ever done before?
I love it when you say that, because when people say that, it makes me want to do it even more. People from West Virginia have a spirit that you just can't quench. And the best way to get them to achieve something is tell them they can't do it. I may fail, but if I fail, I don't have to worry about the question, the nagging question, when I'm on my last days, did I ever try? Did I ever try to take on something that no one else has been able to figure out in giving hope and choices to other people? I can answer that question and say, yes, I gave everything I had in my life to try to do that.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jean Snediger.
Jake Harriman and three other leaders in science and business will be featured in the upcoming documentary Inspiring West Virginians, airing Monday, December 29th at 8 o'clock in the evening on West Virginia Public Radio and wvpublic.org. Ron Rash is a poet, novelist, and short story writer whose 2009 novel, Serena, was a New York Times bestseller. Rash's signature subject is life in Appalachia, past and present. A large collection of the short stories about that region has just come out. Book critic Maureen Corrigan contributed this review for a recent episode of NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross.
Expect to be good for nothing for a long time after you read Ron Rash. His writing is powerful, stripped down, and very still. It takes you to a land apart, psychologically and geographically, since his fiction is set in Appalachia. 34 of Rash's best short stories from the past 20 years have just been published in a collection called Something Rich and Strange. They are that, indeed. Some of these stories are cold to the bone. Others are empathetic and even funny. A few are set during the Great Depression and Civil War. Most, though, take place in the present, an era when illegal ginseng plots and meth labs have supplanted the moonshine stills of an earlier generation, and family farms have given way to vacation home developments. Rash, however, is no nostalgic mountain minstrel bemoaning the loss of the good old days. If it's wood smoke and sylvan sentimentality you're yearning for, you'd be better off watching reruns of The Waltons. The kickoff story of this collection, called Hard Times, is one of the Depression-era tales. It's set on a farm owned by a couple named Jacob and Edna. Somebody's been stealing a few eggs every night from their hen house. Their closest neighbors are a family of three, called the Hartleys, a husband, a wife, and a little girl. As bad off as Jacob and Edna are, the Hartleys are worse. As Jacob says, you couldn't grow a toenail on Hartley's land. One morning, Jacob and Edna spot the Hartleys and their hound dog walking down a nearby trail for their twice-weekly trip to town. Edna yells, "That hound of yours, is it an egg sucker?" In answer, Hartley calls his dog, grabs it by the scruff of its neck, and settles his pocket knife against its throat. We're told that Hartley's wife and daughter stood perfectly still, their faces blank as dough. Jacob tries to stop things, protesting that nobody knows for sure that the dog is the culprit. But Hartley kills the dog anyway, saying, "You'll know for sure now." The story ends on a surprise turn, a moment of generosity that fleetingly counterbalances the mercilessness of this hard life. Mercilessness also characterizes the atmosphere of many of the modern-day stories in Rash's collection, specifically those that chronicle the rural meth epidemic. In Waiting for the End of the World, a roadhouse musician looks at his stoned bandmate, a guy named Sammy, and jokes, "One of the great sins of the 60s was introducing drugs to the good old boy element of Southern society. If you were some Harvard psychology professor like Timothy Leary, drugs might well expand your consciousness, but they work just the opposite way for people like Sammy, shriveling the brain to a reptilian level of aggression and paranoia. That droll observation aside, the meth stories are mostly so hopeless that to read them is to feel like you're wandering alone, lost in a winter wood. Back of Beyond focuses on a pawnbroker who buys the false teeth, butter churns, and bicycle tires addicts trade for cash. One of those addicts is the pawnbroker's own nephew. Another meth story called Those Who Are Dead Are Only Now Forgiven may be the standout of this collection. It's about two teenagers who are smart and in love and determined to get scholarships to college instead of winding up cutting carcasses at the local poultry plant. Although this is a story packed with sharp insights about class and the practical limits to dreaming big, it's also infused with the supernatural aura of a Poe tale. There's an abandoned house in this story, and meth is the demon that haunts it. The pull of that house, especially to teenagers who are working so hard to better themselves against such tough odds, is seductive and deadly. You may think, as a reader, that you too would be better off staying away from that haunted house, or that pawnbroker's shop, or those stark farmhouses, but think again. Rash's spectacular stories may originate in the peculiar soil of Appalachia, but their reach and their rewards are vast.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. You can find links to her books as well as Ron Rash's Something Rich and Strange on our website, wvpublic.org. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky. Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Jake Sheps, the Sweetback Sisters, the Glenville State Bluegrass Band, the Black Twig Pickers, and Andrea Tomasi. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org, find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.